Boom, we're on. And today's guest, we've got George Bamby. How are you, Georgie?
I'm all right, Jamesy. Thanks for having us on, mate.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. You've got a fascinating story. Worked in a paparazzi. A lot of, uncovered a lot of tales. But recently, you've just discovered that the most punished prisoner in the UK, Charlie Bronson, is your father.
Yeah, that's right. Found out that 3 or 4 years ago. And yeah, we've sort of formed a relationship, got to know each other, and I visit him quite regularly, and we speak each other on the phone every day, and sorted him out a brand new legal team, got rid of all the dickheads that were surrounding him and making him look a complete idiot in the media and all the rest of it. And yeah, things are moving forward and looking very positive for his release.
For the first time in many years.
Yeah, yeah, 46 years he's been inside. There was a specialist legal team that got Harry Roberts out. Do you remember Harry Roberts?
No.
He was the one that killed three police officers. Killed three coppers in the 60s. And he was told he would never, ever see the light of day, never get out of prison, which is understandable, killing three coppers. And this certain legal team got him out. And I've been trawling the UK for the last few years and managed to get hold of this top legal guy and literally got on my hands and knees in his offices and begged him to take Charlie on. And he kept turning it down. And then I just said, listen, I'm not fucking leaving you alone until you take him on. And that's it. And then in the end, they did. And now the progress that's been made legally has been amazing. I mean, we've done more in the last 18 months than has been done in the last 40 odd years. And I don't know whether people know about this, but the parole system, basically, if someone's getting a parole, they send three people into the prison. They sit there on a little board, they walk you in, give you a cup of water and sit there and go, have you been a good boy? Read all these bullshit reports and all this bollocks. Get people coming in, talking about them and all the rest of it. They go out, this is in the prison, and then the three people go in the back, have a cup of tea and a biscuit and go, should we let him out or not? Stamp a thing, come back. And Charlie keeps getting denied his parole. And one of the reasons we believe this has been happening is because he's battered that many screws over the years. Obviously, people are interconnected. And, you know, he might have battered someone 20 years ago that now working in the you know, Ministry of Justice, that's worked his way up the chain and all the rest of it. And these things coming from above that are always putting the kibosh on any progression that he's done. So what we've done, we've set a legal precedent and we did this judicial review and a legal challenge to try and get Charlie's next parole hearing heard in a public court. Because our argument was, if a group of 12 people and a jury are good enough to send you to prison for 20 years, then surely a group of 12 people and a judge are good enough to decide whether he should be let out again. And also, being in a public forum, in a courtroom, it keeps everything really transparent and everyone can see what's going on. All the reports are all done properly. There's witnesses, there's members of the press there. You know, people can talk about every single aspect of his behaviour and what he's been doing. And hopefully, he'll have more chance of getting out.
How many times has he been knocked back for parole?
Oh, every time. Never, ever been paroled. Every 2 years, it's like, right, fuck off, back to your bedroom for 2 years. You're not coming out.
How's his mental health just now?
Well, this is one thing that I've been working through with him for the last few years. We talk about lots of different things to do with his mental health. And we believe that, I mean, he'd been in Broadmoor, you know. It was sectioned. It was told that he was insane, which is a load of bollocks. He's not insane at all. He's one of the cleverest blokes you'll ever meet. And his mental health, what happens is, 20 years ago, if you're in a prison cell and you're locked in, and you're locked in for like 3 months and you don't see anyone, they're putting your food under a hole in the gate, do you know what I mean? You don't have any interaction with anyone. What was happening was, they were coming in and just for him to kick the shit out of a couple of guards was an excuse for him to get a bit of attention and get a bit of something to do, do you know what I mean? Can you imagine the boredom? So he'd come out, he'd have a rumble with 12 guards, he'd you know, have a proper scramble, get back in the cell, and be like, yes, brilliant, I've had something exciting in my life. But then what would happen is, them guards would go out, and in them days, they'd have a bar down the end of the road, like the prison officer's mess. So they go and get pissed at dinner time, have a few jars or whatever, come back to the landing and think, oh, fuck it, let's go and give Charlie a good hiding. And they'd open his door and steam in with bats and all sorts and batter the shit out of him. And they were doing that all the time. And that's what made him so violent and so hard, because all he was doing was just fighting back all the time. I mean, if you're there and 12 people come in and kick the shit out of you every other day for the next 3 months, after a bit, it's going to become second nature to you, isn't it? So they actually created their own monster, if you like.
So he become very anti-authority?
Yeah, of course he did. Every time that cell door opened, he just wanted to think, right, it's them, me against them, and he'd be in.
We'll touch on a lot of stories, because I know you speak to your dad 3 times a day sometimes, and you've become very close with him, you're fighting to get him out. But I always go back to the start of my guest to get a better understanding of you, George, and what you've been through in your life, and tell me where it all started for you.
Well, I had a bit of a messed up life, to be honest. I was brought up in care. My mum was an alcoholic. I didn't know who my dad was, and I was brought up by my stepdad. And, had a bit of a shit time, getting battered all the time, locked in my room all the time, you know, made to eat dog meat sandwiches, locked in my bedroom to shit on the bedroom floor and all this sort of stuff, shot with a little pellet gun all the time. And they did a film about me, actually, called Stepdad, which you can watch. Like, Ricky Tomlinson's in it, there's quite a few famous people in it. And I was one of the first people in the UK to prosecute my own mum and stepdad. So, so I grew up in care. I went into care when I was about 6 the first time. And, just grew up with a load of kids and all that. Had a bit of a laugh.
How was your schooling and stuff? Did you go to school, George, or was it care all the time?
Well, I was in care all the time. I did quite well. I went to 13 different schools before I was 11. So I was quite disrupted all the time. But the thing is, when I was locked in my bedroom all the time as a kid, I had fuck all to do, because I didn't have any toys, didn't have anything like that. When it was Christmas, any presents I got, my mum used to sell them, you know what I mean? So when I was at school, I used to nick loads of books from school, maths books and English books and all this, science books, and I'd take them home, and when I got locked in my bedroom, I'd read all these books all the time. So I did really well. I passed my maths O-level when I was 11 years old, which I was really pleased about. And I remember Mr. Roberts, the maths teacher, come round and knocked on the door. And my mum answered the door, and he said, "Hello, I'm Mr. Roberts from the school, blah, blah, blah. I wanted to come round and have a chat with you about George taking his 11 plus. And this was the first year of secondary school. Said, "We think he's got a good chance of passing it." And she went, "Do what the fuck you want, I'm not fucking bothered." Slammed the door, and that was it. So I didn't really know what was going on, so I went back to school. Anyway, I was in this hall doing this exam, and I was 11, and all the other kids were like 16, and they're all like, "What's he doing here?" And so I did this exam, and that was it. Didn't think anything of it. It was all done or whatever. And then we had assembly a few months later, and they were, you remember at school, you have the first years, then the second years, third years, fourth, fifth years, all in a layer or whatever. And they were giving all these results out. So the fifth year students who were like, "Right, and and then they'd all come forward onto the stage, shake hands with the headmaster and all this bollocks. And then they went, "And we've got somebody that we want to bring up on the stage that's not in year 5. He's actually in year 1, and he's passed his maths O level. And we're inviting," and they called my name out, and I was like, "Fucking hell." And I went up on the stage and I got my maths O level when I was 11. That's the only exam I ever took. It's the only exam I've ever had.
So you're quite well educated when you put your mind to it.
Yeah, sort of forced into it and enjoyed it. It was the only enjoyment I had, really.
How was in your teenage years coming from a bit of turmoil in your past? Did you struggle?
I had a bit of a nightmare when I was 12 because I got blown up on one of them electric pylons. And I was out with my cousin David, and we were messing about, and and we thought it'd be a good idea to climb up this electric pylon. So we did, and I got all these like 68% burns on my body. And yeah, I just climbed up this pylon and it threw me off it, and I ended up in hospital for 2 years in a place called Booth All Children's Hospital. And I've had over 180 operations, because when you get burned, as you grow, your skin doesn't grow, so you have to keep releasing it and all this. So, but that was really hard, because I never had any visitors. I literally didn't have any family coming to see me. I mean, my auntie Doc came to see me once, which was really nice of her, but I didn't want her to come and see me again, because I didn't want people to be upset seeing me in the state that I was in, and I was up to my eyes in morphine and all this, and I was just enjoying the buzz, really. I was just fucking lying there off my tits all the time. And every time I wanted some more drugs, I'd just press this button, and this nurse turned up and injected this thing into my drip, and I was like floating off again. It was...
Yeah. That's sad, George. A 12-year-old kid in hospital alone.
Yeah, it was sad. It was. It was, but to be honest, I was quite happy to be on my own, because my mum... was there in the first stages. She was there for the first couple of months. And there was a place called Marathon House where parents could stay. So basically, because her and my stepdad were like, you know, alkies and fucking pissed and fighting all the time or whatever, she didn't come to see me. She came and stayed in this Marathon House place, and she used to go out and get pissed at the pub with the other mums every night. And like, oh, my poor son George, you're all buying the fucking drinks and all this lot, you know what I mean? So in the end, the nurses, the doctors come in one day and they just said, how do you feel about your mum being here? And I said, I fucking hate her, I don't want her here, tell her to fuck off. And then the doctors made her move out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. I think she's just using it more of a convenience thing, do you know what I mean?
When did you go out of the hospital? What age were you, 14, 15?
Yeah, I went in on June the 14th, 1984, and I finished all my main treatment a couple of years after. So, I'd be in for like 6 months, and then I'd be out for a couple of weeks, then I'd be back in for another 4 months, out for a couple of weeks. But I mean, when it first started, generally, yeah, it was a couple of years just intensive all the time.
Do you still get treatment for it or anything? Do you still have to do checkups?
Yeah, still have to have releases done and all that. I mean, now I'm getting a bit of a fat bastard. I think my skin's stretching a bit more. I have to have a couple of bit more. But yeah, it gets all sort of tight here and all that sort of stuff. So I had to have all them released and whatever.
So you nearly died then at 12?
I was in a bad way. What was 250,000 volts. Fucking hell, have you ever touched the plug?
I get a shock when I open the car door and I shake myself.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, I'll never forget that feeling. It was like...
Was the hair not sticking up? Were you smoking?
My hair was stuck up. I was smoking like fuck. I was smouldering when I went into the hospital. I was still smouldering.
That's scary.
Because what happens is that where my burns are is where my clothes were. So the electric's that powerful, it travels up your body and sets your clothes on fire. So, but I remember when it happened, clear as day. My cousin David, he was on the bottom of this train, I was on the top of this train, grabbed hold of this thing, and then it was literally... All I remember, it was like being on a spaceship and someone's opened the door and gone, right, fuck off, and booted me out. And I'm just flying through space like, hold on, where the fuck am I? Mm-hmm. And that's what it was like. It was mad. And then I woke up and I was on the ground and sort of like a starfish. And all the grass around me was on fire. And our David was looking over going, fucking hell, drop me some piss on you. Yeah. And I went, piss on me. If you fucking piss on me, I'll pull your fucking cock off. Don't piss on me. And I'm like, and then it just went all a bit tits up from there. I was awake for 3 days when I went into intensive care.
Is that where all the electricity going through your body?
It's just the shock. When your body goes into shock, shock's a very funny thing.
Especially with the burn marks. But fair play, man, for kicking on and... It's never really held you back because you're known as the paparazzi guy. You've seen a lot of your videos and stuff.
The UK's number one paparazzi.
Yeah, UK's number one on the UK's number one podcast, bro. Huh? But how did you get into the photography side of things? Was that always a dream or a passion?
I don't know. I've always been interested in like being successful. As a result of my childhood, I've always wanted to be really successful. I've always wanted to have loads of money, have loads of businesses and do really well and bring, you know, have kids myself and bring them up and give them the lifestyle that I never had. you know, never hit my children, anything like whatever. So I've just always been looking for things that, you know, I tried to set loads of businesses up, fucking car valeting, building barbecues and all this shit when I was 16, and, you know, nothing ever worked. And then I saw this TV programme once about the paparazzi, and I saw these blokes running around with big cameras and all that, earning 10 grand, 15 grand. I thought, fucking hell, that's a good job. And there was a big fat bloke from Australia with a Mohican in London called Darren Lyons, an Australian bloke. You must have known him, because he was battering Kerry all the time. He had photographers. Mm-hmm. Big fat bloke with a Mohican. He was on Big Brother with his sewn in.
He was a right wanker.
So I phoned up. He had a big company, Big Pictures. So I phoned up and I said, I want to work as a paparazzi. And they're like, oh yeah, thanks for ringing, bye. And just put the phone down. So I thought, fucking, this TV show's been on. No one's, you know, everyone's probably ringing up. So I thought, oh, fuck it. So I just jumped on a train to London. So I went to London and I got over to their offices. And I went to their offices and I just waited outside. And I waited for this Darren Lyons to come in. And he walked in. And as he walked in, I held the door open behind him. So he walked in, so I walked in behind him. He got in the lift. So I got in the lift with him. And he goes, all right, mate, how you doing? I went, yeah, I'm all right. How you doing? All right. And he says, yeah, yeah. He said, who are you coming to see? I said, I've come to see you. And he went, have we got an appointment? I went, no. I said, he said, what have you come to see me for? I said, I want to be a paparazzi. He said, oh, mate, you need to send your CV in or send your fucking details in. I'm fucking busy. Da, 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 da. I said, listen, I've just got on a train all the way from Manchester. I've come to see you and I'm going to fucking see you whether you like it or not. And he said, so what's so special about you then? So I said, I'm Wayne Rooney's best mate. And he went, right, fucking two coffees in it. And that was it. And then we went in the office.
So just kind of blagged your way
in. Yeah, so we went in and I said, he said, how do you know Wayne? And I said, oh, he lives near me. I said, yeah, I fucking talk to him all the time and all this and blah, blah, blah. And I'd get loads of pictures. I know where he is and all this, blah, whatever. And then about 20 minutes later, I walked out with a fucking 4 grand camera and 22 grand a year salary. I got back on the train. I didn't even know how to use the fucking camera. Mm-hmm. And I'd never met Wayne Rooney.
You done that? Is it Rooney Mooney?
Yeah, the Rooney Mooney. That's one of my most famous.
Is that when you had your ass out walking by Colleen Rooney? And
yeah.
How did that come about?
I just whipped my pants down.
But
basically, when you're doing these pictures, what you've got to do is you've got to come up with something that no one's got. Get some think outside the box. So every night, it was at the World Cup in Germany. And we were all over in Germany. And all the paparazzi, they were all doing the players at their hotel. And this was in the early days when the money was mega. It was mega dough. So I thought to myself, what the fuck's... Why am I here with all the footballers? I'm going to go to the hotel where all the wives are and see what all them are up to. Because they're the ones that selling the magazines. I mean, all right, the footballers selling the papers, but the women selling the magazines. And the magazines used to pay loads of money. So I went down to the hotel, booked into the same hotel as them, and got chatting to a few people and finding out, you know, when they were going to the nightclubs and all this, that and the other. So I used to follow them, just take all the pictures, send them all in, made loads of dough. And then one night, there was another photographer turned up from another agency. And I thought, all right, there's two of us here now, so we're not going to get any exclusive stuff. So I said, listen, we need to work together and keep everything exclusive. We can still sell it for a fortune. And we just come up with some ideas. So there was one that we come up with, and this young lad was outside the hotel, and the players used to come back to this hotel to see the missuses every 3 or 4 days. They were allowed in for an hour. So one of these lads outside, he just loved Rio Ferdinand. So I was trying to think of something to do with Rio Ferdinand. So I said to the kid's dad, I said, listen, I'll sort it out. I'll get Rio to do an autograph for him and all this, blah, blah, blah. I said, but your son needs to do something for me. And there was this joke shop down the road and they sold these artificial shits, right? So it's a big long shite. So I went into this little factory down the road, got them to drill a hole in it and stuck a pen up inside this shit. So I've got this little kid and he's got his pad or whatever. So I says, right, it'll be dead funny. Rio will laugh his head off. You'll love this, but I'll definitely get you an autograph and a photo. So I give this kid this artificial shit and this pad, and he was outside the hotel. And when the team bus turned up, taking a few pictures, Rio got off And he's walking off, and I said, Rio, I said, there's a young lad down there. He said, he's only six. I said, he's been waiting for fucking 4 hours for your autograph. Just sign his autograph for him. And Rio goes, yeah, all right. So he walks over. So I said to this lad, just give him the pad and give him that. So he gave him the pad, give him this thing. And he signed his autograph. And then Rio looked at this thing, and he's like, fuck's that? Give it him back, walked in. So I snapped the picture, sent it into Fleet Street, and I captioned it, Rio Turdinand. That was the headline.
What's the most you've made for what's the most you can make for exclusive photos?
Well, it depends. I mean, some pictures, I mean not so much now because it's all gone online, the papers have like lost all the circulation and all the rest of it, but some pictures in the older days you get 30 grand.
That's unbelievable grand. Though, isn't it?
You could get go back to the early late 90s. You could get 7-8 grand for Charlotte Church going to Tesco's with Gavin Henson doing a bit of shopping.
Is that why some photographers are ruthless? Because the money can be made in it?
In them days they were, yeah. I mean, you'd have people hiding in wheelie bins, hiding in people's gardens, hiding in the fucking sheds, because chasing them down the road.
Because I know you went to try and get Prince Harry and Prince William, and did the royal family, people put you in a van and put a gun to your head?
It was MI, well, I assume it was MI5. They don't really introduce themselves, you know what I mean? I was that was in Tetbury in Gloucestershire. And, basically I've turned up and they were playing polo. So I've got this gas fan and the gas fan's cut an hole out the side of it, literally with a grinder. So you cut an hole in the side of the van so I could go inside the van and shoot pictures outside it. And so I've turned up and I've got a sign on the side, can you smell gas? Ringo 800 treble 5 treble 1, because that's like a normal gas company, you know what I mean? So I've turned up and there's no way of getting in. So I just drove up to the counter, drove up to the main entrance, and they said, have you got a pass? And I went, no. And they went, well, you can't come in. I said, all right then. Well, if you don't want any fucking gas bottles for the roast dog, it's up to you. Fuck it. See you later. So I've gone to reverse, and the guy's gone, hold on a minute. What are you doing? I said, I'm bringing a couple of gas bottles for the hog tent or whatever. And they went, oh, right, okay, yeah, hold on, right. There's a guy coming through with some gas bottles for the tent. So they waved me through. So they waved me through, so I drove up. There's police everywhere. I mean, you know, Prince Harry and Prince William and all that are there. So, you know, it's proper fucking guns and shit, you know what I mean? So I drove up to this tent, got out, and just went up to the bloke at the tent, like, all right, mate, how's it going? You all right? What time's the Ogro starting? Just talking shit to him so he could see me talking to him. And then got back in the van or whatever. And then I drove round the back. And as I drove round the back, I saw a bit of grass and thought, the plane over there, I'll pull up here. So I pulled up on the grass facing where the pitch was. So I'm in the back of the van. And I've moved my little sign from the outside. I've got my camera ready to do them and all this. And nothing's happening. I thought, oh, fucking... Anyway, I fell asleep in the back of the van. And then about however long later, there's a bang on the back of the van. And they're going, right, X-ray 564 TFP or whatever on the radio. And I'm like, that's my reg number. What's going on here? It's checking my van out. And so it's obviously Special Bank's checking my van out. So I've opened the back of the van. As I've opened the back of the van, there's about 30 ponies all around my van. And where I'd parked up, that's where they were bringing all the ponies for the polo match. And they were like, what are you doing here? I went, oh, I'm really sorry. I parked in the wrong place. I've been driving for hours. I was just having a kip in the back of the van. I'm really sorry. And they're like, right, okay, you need to go back up. You know, you need to go out to the main. So I went up, went to the main car park, and they were trying to see me out. So as they see me out, I blagged it staying in. So I basically stayed in there. And when Harry and William come out, I was like mixed in with the crowd and everything. And I was just taking loads of pictures. And I had got near the tent, inside the tent where they were. And I got some really good pictures of Harry making a cup of coffee and all this sort of shite. And that was it. And then I was walking across this bit of grass, walked past this car, and the next thing, fucking bag goes over my head and I'm dragged into the back of this van. And I've got in there and I'm like, there's a fucking guy there with a gun, right? Police officers, a couple of police officers. There's a couple of guys in plain clothes. And one of them goes... hello, Mr. Bambi. And I was like, oh, hello. Like, what did you say? Do you know what I mean? And he went, we just thought we'd bring you into our little van just to let you know that we want you to go back into your shitty little van and get on the M5 and head south, and you're going to have a police escort to the next junction. And if you come anywhere near Tetbury in the next 48 hours, your life's not going to be worth living. Do you understand? And I was like, yeah. And then they took me out of the van, and I walked down towards my van, and literally there must have been about 10 or 12 guys, all plain clothes, not walking next to me, but sort of circling me as I was walking to make sure I got back in the van. And then I got back in the van, drove off, and as I drove off, there's a car in front of me, a car behind me and all this. And I got onto the M5 and started heading south. And then I got a couple of junctions down, and a couple of junctions down, these two big black unmarked cars went past me. And as I went past the next junction, they drove past and just went like that. out the window, no. And I just carried on driving and went home.
Did they take your camera off you?
No.
The film or
no,
anything?
No, they didn't. But when I got home, about half an hour after being at home, I sat there with the missus, and there was a knock on the door. I've opened the door, and there was two coppers at the door, and I went, "Oh, you're all right." And they said, "Can we come in?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Oh, we don't want to alarm you, but there's 12 of us." And they all came in the house, and the missus is on the couch. I'm like, "What the fuck's going on?" They came in, they took all my cameras, all my laptops, iPads, computers, memory cards, the whole fucking lot. And they said to the missus, "We can't tell you why we're arresting him. We can't tell you why we're arresting him. Blah, blah, blah. The Anti-Terrorism Act and all this sort of shit," they start quoting. Then they took me down to the police station. It was like 8 o'clock at night. And locked me up in a cell. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, they came in with a pasty and a coffee and said, "We'll be back in 10 minutes. 10 minutes later, they came back and said, "Oh, it's all been a big misunderstanding. We shouldn't have arrested you. We're really sorry. We're going to drop you back home now. We're not going to be taking any charges against you. We're going to bring all your stuff home." And I went back home, and they'd wiped all my camera cards, all my pictures of William and Harry, and deleted the whole fucking lot.
Was that just to make sure that you weren't a terrorist or gathering information too, maybe?
Well, possibly, but it was also, they might have been probably scared maybe I'd got some pictures that I shouldn't have had or something or whatever. But, I mean, you're dealing with the establishment. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is one thing that I've always, it's always made me, like, think about things a bit different. I used to go down and do David Cameron when he was on holiday in Cornwall. And I remember the first time I got some pictures of David Cameron. And literally, he's got, like, loads of armed guards with him. They've all got guns. They're all in, like, bulletproof motors and all the rest of it. And I got on the beach when he's in the water and fired him right in front of everyone else. He didn't see I had a camera. We had it hidden under my towel. I got a load of pictures of him. And the next day, they were in all the papers. And there was that one. Do you remember Ken Bigley when he'd been decapitated?
Yeah.
It was a front page picture. It was like, "Ken Bigley's been decapitated. Where the fuck's David Cameron? On holiday surfing." So they were in the front page. But then the next day, when the paper come out, I got like about, I'm not joking, about 600 friend requests off all these people with all this Asian writing and stuff. You know, Muslim, people from Muslim backgrounds with all this writing. "I want to be your friend," and, you know, all the blah. And I like shit myself, because obviously he was on the number one list for Cameron, isn't he? The ISIS, because all that shit was going on at the minute. So I had to go down to the police station and say, "Look, I've had all these friend requests." And they sent someone down and they took all the requests and everything off my phone and all the information for, like, intel gathering or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was it. But I could have fucking put a bullet in his head.
Yeah, you could have been anybody. That just should, is that not show you how weak the intelligence can be then from some of these guards and stuff, if you're sneaking in just with a gas man?
Yeah, I reckon the security for David Cameron and people like that was so bad, I could have taken him out 10 times. Mm-hmm. There was times when I was parked in the car park where he goes for a swim, in the back of my van with a camera through a hole cut in the side of my van, that I've shot loads of pictures of him. If I'd have had a gun and I was a sniper, I could have taken him out.
Yeah. What about, so if you get a good photo, say like Prince Harry, Prince William, how does it go about? Do you auction it to the highest bidder?
Well, it depends what you've got. If you've got a really good set of pictures, I mean, I know if I've got a really good set of pictures, and because I've been doing it for so long and I work for myself, I have a good relationship with most of the editors that deal with all the pictures and stuff. So I contact the editors direct and say, "Right, you know, I've got my guys at the Sun. I just go, right, I've got this. I know they want it. I'm like, how much are you going to give me? And we agree a price. And if the price isn't good enough, I'll just say, if you don't fucking pay me what I want, I'm going somewhere else. And they go, right, we'll pay you what you want then, if it's something that they really want, and that's it. But sometimes you shoot a really good set of pictures and think, oh, I'm going to get $5,000-$10,000 for these. And then you send them in and the paper's like, yeah, we're not interested. And you're like, what? So then you go to the next paper, then the next paper. And then other times you shoot a set of pictures and you think, oh, fucking waste of time, they are. You'll send them in and they start a bidding war for them. Just, you never know what's going on in their heads at the moment or what stories they're doing or...
Yeah, what's popular.
Yeah.
How do you... What's the biggest story you've went undercover to get photos of anyone?
That's a good question. I'm very proud of this fact. I know a lot of people will think this is a load of bollocks. You know, you get all these paedophile hunters and all this. And everyone says, oh, they shouldn't be getting involved, they shouldn't be doing this and blah, blah. Well, it's nothing to do with that, but it's quite similar. I've been the only photographer that's managed to get certain people. Do you remember Shannon Matthews?
No.
The young girl that was kidnapped by her mum. Her mum was called Karen Matthews and they hid her under the bed.
Not sure.
Fucking have you got a TV at? You must have heard of Karen Matthews.
I only watch my own stuff.
I bet you do and all. So Karen Matthews lived in Dewsbury and she had a little daughter called Shannon. And basically they made out that the daughter had gone missing and there was this massive nationwide hunt for her and everyone was looking for her. And it turned out like 2 months later that she was being held captive by her brother-in-law and they were going to keep the ransom money. So she was like the UK's most hated...
I remember it.
She was like the UK's most hated figure. So she went to prison. When she came out of prison, she did like 8 years or whatever. And when she came out of prison, all the papers want the very first pictures of her coming out. But the thing is, when they come out of prison, they take them to a safe house. And to find someone in a safe house is nigh on impossible. I mean, you've got to know what you do. You've got to know people. So when she came out, I was the first one to find her and get the pictures. And then on top of that, there was another woman called Vanessa George, who was the female paedophile that had abused all these kids at a nursery in Plymouth. She was like public enemy number one. And she got let out after 7 years. And I found her and got all the pictures of her. And a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you saw it in the Sun, it was last week, I think, you know this May Reed Philpott?
Yeah.
Her and her husband, Mick Philpott, they set fire to the house and killed the 6 kids. She got released out of prison, and they've been after her for 2 months, and they couldn't get any pictures of her, and I turned up and smashed her within 3 days, and had a full page of her in the Sun, so... I don't do it for money anymore. I'm quite well established in my life. I've got businesses. I've got, you know, my life's all hunky-dory. I don't need to do this business anymore. So I sort of pick and choose the jobs that I want to do now.
Do you get a thrill from that, George?
Yeah, it's like fishing.
Do you ever fear for your life?
Oh, fuck me, yeah.
Obviously, if you're getting guns put to your head.
Yeah, I fear for my life a few times. I mean, see, the problem is, you know yourself, you've met loads of celebrities. I've met loads of celebrities. And what happens is, like, you know, someone like Gazza or someone like that, you know, a lot of these celebrities are really nice people. But the danger is the people around them. Because what happens is people want to be the friend. They want to be seen to be looking after them and protecting them and da-da-da-da-da. So... You know, if you do something wrong with a certain celebrity, their mates are like, I'm going to fucking hunt you down. I'm going to kidnap your fucking kids. I'm going to rape your wife. I'm going to fucking shoot you. I'm going to do it. And you're just like, fucking hell. You get it all the time. You've just got to go in one ear.
What is that the kind of threats you've had?
Oh, all the time. When I did my TV show, I got a TV show with Channel 4, Confessions of the Paparazzi. And I was the only paparazzi that they wanted on it. I was the number one paparazzi in the UK. I'd had nearly 400 front pages. And I like to think I'm a bit of a character or whatever. So they got in touch and said, we want to do a TV show with you. And I was like, oh, I'm not really that bothered, to be honest. And then they phoned me back and I was like, how much? Fuck it, right, let's do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we did that. And it came out and we did like, did a main one on the channel. It was like a main 1 hour program. And then we did like 7 other episodes. It's really weird when you're on primetime TV with your own show, because you watch it on the telly and then you finish and you go to bed And then you wake up in the morning, you're like, fucking hell. You've got like 600 messages and you've got like 2,000 friend requests and you've got messages off this, message off, everything from fuck me, you're a legend, to I'm going to rape your wife and all this. And it's just like trying to get your head around it all and you're like, what's going on? Do you know what I mean?
How do you feel with the shoe in the other foot? Did paparazzi ever try and get you once you started to get into the limelight?
Yeah, I had a couple of photographers turned up at the house taking photographs. How did you feel? I just came out the house and I went, here, I'll fucking take a few photos of me and what do you want me to do?
Because you can understand, I'll just try to make a crust.
Went in the shop, bought a paper, mm-hmm. took a few pictures, fucked off, went back home, that was it, happy days.
Because I had Gaza on and I thought he's a legend. Yeah, on you go.
I'll tell you something about Gaza. Yeah. There's only two rules that I've got, right? Gaza's a hero of mine.
Yeah, same.
There's only two rules I've ever had, and they were never ever take a picture of someone with the kids, which I've never done, and never ever take a picture of someone that's ill. And that's why I've never done Gaza. The Sun and all the other papers, you know, they've all said, go and get Gaza. And I'm like, I wouldn't fucking touch him.
Yeah, because the press killed people, because I had Gaza on last week, and that's what he says, that they used to leave
bottles of whiskey outside his house.
And then when he used to put it in the bin, he used to say, oh, he's back in the drink and stuff. That can be sad because the press, I believe, can kill people. And if you're struggling with mental health, it can push you over the edge.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I did something really bad with Richard and Judy once. One of the magazines was saying Judy was an alcoholic, and I knew she wasn't. So I got one of my mates to give her a bottle of red wine at one of the book signings and took a picture of her and all this. And it was on all the front pages. Judy's got a drink problem, out of control and all this. But it's different league with Gaza, because Gaza is an alcoholic. And he has got a problem. And he's been working really hard to sort all his shit out or whatever. But I actually know people that were putting bottles of vodka outside his front door and ringing the bell and waiting for him to come out and pick it up. And, you know, hopefully go in and drink the bottle and come out absolutely plastered to get another bottle and they could get loads of... I mean, that is just shit to me.
Yeah. Did you ever target their best friends, family members? Because you see family members selling stories all the time. Did you know who was weak around high-class celebrities to target them? Because money talks.
Yeah, it does. Money does talk. And I've got a lot of friends. See, the difference is I'm a photojournalist and reporters are print journalists. So what happens is photos, we do whatever photos we do, right? A lot of these people, they think they've got loads of close friends around them. Most of them haven't got anybody they can trust. You know, we have friends, sisters, brothers, aunties, uncles. One celebrity, an A-lister, a fucking mum used to ring me to tell me what she was doing. That's how bad it is. They can't trust anybody. But the reporters, they're the sort of ones that go around looking in the bins, looking at the letters that they've put in the bin and speaking to the sisters and the brothers and this and digging in and getting copies of bank accounts and stuff. That's all different yeah. world to mine.
So now we're going to your dad, Charlie Bronson, Britain's most punished prisoner. 46 years he's been in prison. I think he's been free just over 100 days.
Yeah.
Is this where the relationship started, when your dad seen you on the TV? How did that come about, George?
He was watching this programme on Channel 4, Confessions of the Paparazzi, and he saw me name, George Bambi, and at the time, I was like 46, and he was like, George Bambi? It's a pretty unusual name, isn't it? And who I thought was my real dad, who was on my birth certificate, his name was George Bambi. And I went to see... Paula got in touch with me, Paula Salvador, who my old man married, and said, Charles Bronson wants to see you in prison. So I was like, Charles Bronson wants to see me in prison?
Did you think you'd done something wrong?
I don't know what, but my arse was tweaking a bit. I was like, fucking hell, what does he want? And so that was it. So I was sort of a mixture of excitement, a bit puzzled, blah, blah, blah. So this is, he wanted me to come and see him. It took like 6 to 8 months to get on the approved list to get to be able to visit him, because he's such high category. He's classed as in the top 8 most dangerous prisoners in the country. Well, he is the most dangerous prisoner in the country. So you go through this 6 to 8 month rigmarole of getting in. And the prison service got in touch with me and I filled the forms in and all that. And I was approved in 48 hours. And I was like, fucking, that's a bit weird. So I went to see him. And I went to see me Paula the first time, and I walked in, and he just, like, where was it? I thought, it was at Wakefield, in the cage he was in Wakefield a few years ago. And I walked in, and they took me through all these metal detectors, all these machines, fucking eye retina scans, fingerprint scans, through all these doors. You know, they did everything apart from crawl up my arse to see what I had on me. I mean, literally, it is like Heathrow Airport times 100, you know what I mean? Which you can understand. So anyway, I was shitting myself. I had to walk all through the prison, all past all the wings and all that outside, all the excise yards. And in Wakefield, it's a prison inside the prison, on the other side of the prison. And it's a special unit, the CSC unit, the close supervision centre. So I went in, and they've opened this fucking massive gate, and I'm like shitting myself. I can hear Charlie going, "What the fuck is going on? Fucking 5 past fucking 2 and he's not here. What the fuck? I'm going to fucking knock someone out in a minute." He's giving it all this. I was like, fucking hell. So as I walked through this gate, there's an exercise yard on the left. And I looked over and there's this massive bloke about 7 foot. Honestly, he was massive, beard and all that. Like, looked really empty in his eyes. Anyway, they took me down this thing and then turned left. And there's a cage there. And we went into this room and there's all these bars and shit. And Charlie was in there and he was stood upside down doing a headstand singing, "Please release me, let me go." And I was like, so I've walked in, I thought, fucking hell, this is a bit bizarre. So we walked in and he's finished off doing his song. And when he's finished, he's just done a backflip, jumped up and gone, "Hello, Georgie, so nice to meet you." Put his hands through the bar and shook my hands, and I thought, fucking hell, do I grab his hand? What happens if he pulls me in? What do I do? Because you sort of panic, you know what I mean? Yeah, well, it is. That's what it's like. That's what it's like. So when we went in, the door shut behind me, and as the door shut behind me, there's a massive, big, round, bulletproof glass thing on the door. So he's pulled me in, so we're talking away. And then he's just got chatting and all this. And he says, and he told me, "Your dad was a very good friend of mine." And I was like, "How do you know my dad?" And he went, "George Bambi." And on my birth certificate, it says George Bambi. And his occupation was turf accountant. He ran a bookmaker's. And basically, cut a long story short, what happened was with the visits, he said to me that when my dad was running this bookmaker's office, he owed a load of gangsters some money and he was in the shit. So because he owed him this money, him and Charlie, they arranged for Charlie to go in and rob the post office, rob the bookies. So Charlie went in with a fucking shooter and said, "Right, give me all your money." Got away with like 3 or 4 grand. And then him and George Bambi shared the money, right? Who I thought was my real dad. George Bambi disappeared over to Spain with his money and left my mum, wasn't with her anymore. Then what happened was, just after that, Charlie obviously had a bit of a thing going with my mum. He met her at some club in Ellesmere Port. She got pregnant. And then obviously, a few months after whatever happened, George Bambi came back from Spain. Come back from Spain and my mum's pregnant and she's like, "We're having a baby." And at the time, Charlie was in loads of trouble. He was always fucking in trouble with the police, doing robberies and all this shit. So she thought she'd have a better life with George Bambi. So she told him that I was his son, they were pregnant, and that was it. And then he moved back in with her. They were together for about 6 or 7 months. And then Charlie ended up getting sent to prison for 7 years. And George Bambi ended up fucking off. And she was on her own anyway.
So how was that experience then coming from... basically when you're 12 years old, growing up yourself, not really knowing who your real dad was, to then having the life that you've had as a photographer, your own TV show, for then Charlie Bronson to send a message out and say he's your dad, what the fuck were you thinking?
I don't know, it was all a bit fucking mad, to be honest. But I mean, I've been brought up all my life looking after myself and being in kids' homes and all the rest of it. I've never really had any parents, never really bothered about them, never been asked. And that was it. And then when I started meeting up with my dad, we started talking, and then, you know, he started sending me photographs of like my mum and my auntie and friends, and telling me stories and saying, "Oh, do you remember this scar on the back of your mum's hand?" You know, she had a scar on the back of her hand there. And apparently she was in a pub one night and she was pissed and she wanted something to drink. And she had a bet with someone she couldn't put a cigar out on the back of her hand for a fiver. And she wanted some money for beer, so they bet her. So she put this cigar out the back of her hand and she got a big scar on the back of her hand. No one would have ever known about that. There's loads of other different things that he told me that he didn't know about, that I didn't know about, that I've since checked with other family members that have confirmed what was going on. So, yeah, so that was it. And then there was loads of shit. I've had loads of fucking trolls on the internet and loads of people saying, he's not your dad, you're full of shit, you're fucking into PR, you do stuff with the papers, it's all a load of bullshit, it's a marketing exercise, it's a PR scam and all this shit. It's not. I'm not going to go around telling everyone my dad's fucking Charles Bronson. Mm-hmm. Hey, speak of the devil, he's ringing. Shall I answer it?
Yeah.
I'm going to give him a bell. Have a chat. Hello?
I've eaten too much porridge. How are you, son?
Yeah, I'm all right, Dad. How are you doing? All right.
What are you doing? All good?
Yeah, I'm just sitting down having a chat with a mate, James. James.
Oh, yeah. James.
Yeah, he's all right. Yeah, he's a nice lad. He knows. He's had a few chats with Paul Ferris and Dave Dark. Courtney and all that lot. Who else?
Right. He's been in
some good company, didn't he? Vic Dark.
Hey?
Do you know Vic Dark?
Yeah, Vicky Dark. I was in progress with Vicky.
Oh, was you?
Yeah, East Londoner from Canning Town.
Oh, yeah, we were just talking then about how I found out I was your son.
Well, there's a lot of muppets out there who stick their nose in business that don't concern them. Now, for them muppets who keep having little pops at you, don't they realise they're having a pop at me at all?
Yeah, well, just saying to James, I don't really listen to any of the shit off anyone. We've had our DNA test done through the prison service. We know the crack, so I don't listen to that shit, as you know.
Well, the facts are on the table, right? There's no disputing that I was with your mum, right?
You weren't the only one.
She was a raving lunatic, but I'm like a magnet. I always magnetise lunatics to me anyway.
Mm.
Right, so that's not disputed. Second of all you've got to do is look at a photo of you and a photo of me. We got the same nose, the same eye sockets, the same jawline. Any bloody idiot in the world can see you, my son.
Yeah, we're just having a little chat about it, that's all.
Yeah, there's a lot of muppets out there, mate, that just want to cause problems all the time. Well, all I'll say to them muppets are, come and see me later, because I could be out at the end of this year.
I know, I was just telling him about all that legal stuff. We've got this this appeal we've just won, the court case.
Yeah, fantastic. We've just won the High Court. I've got a public parole hearing. I'm just waiting for the date. We're going to smash it, mate.
Yeah.
Because for the last 50 years, paroles have been held behind closed doors. Now, I've just got a new law. They've now got to be a public. So I can have the media in, the public in. There's no more sweeping my case under the mat.
I know, I've done all my speech with the lawyers and that to say in court for you to stand up and tell them about all the good stuff you do. Hey, did you, I've not told James yet. Do you, you realise that record that we brought out, you're number one in Cyprus, number three in Sweden, and number 29 in the British charts? Did you see that on the paper on Sunday? Fucking.
No, I can't believe it. You know that nasty Nick?
Yeah.
Now, I was only having a laugh with him.
Oh, well, everyone could see that.
I told him, I said, Lee, you better stand down, son. I've just smashed my way into the music world. Well, what I'm going to do with Nasty Nick, I'm going to offer him to come on a CD and me and him will do a duo, The Righteous Brothers.
Yeah, that'll be good, won't it?
Yeah, it'll be brilliant.
So Maz is here. We've come up to Glasgow to see Rodney.
Yeah, sad time for you, son.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it? I fucking cried my eyes out all day yesterday. So, so James, he rang up while I was in Glasgow to come and have a chat with him, so it worked out all right, actually.
Oh, well, that's good.
How'd you get on with the doctor? Did you go and see the doctor?
Yeah, get on this. I've got to see the doctors. Now, you know me, I don't like doctors. I don't get involved in doctors.
You don't like anyone?
No. Anyway, I've gone in the doctor's room. He said, hello, John. I've not seen you for years. I says, yeah, I'm in a bit of trouble, Doc. He said, what's your trouble? I said, I'm constipated. He said, how long have you been constipated for, Charlie? I said, 3 months. He said, you haven't had a pony for 3 months. That's right. He said, well, what have you been eating, apart from the prison food? I said, snooker balls. He said, you've been eating snooker balls? I said, I just said that, did I? He said, well, what did you have last night for tea? Shepherd's pie, carrots, potatoes, 3 blacks, a blue and a pink. He said, oh my God, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Scrambled egg, 6 slices of toast, me porridge, and a cup of Rosie Lee. 4 blacks, a pink, a blue and a yellow. He said, well, there's your problem, Charlie. You're not eating enough greens.
Fucking hell.
I'm running out of Sullivan that loved that one.
Yeah, I bet he would, yeah. Oh my God, I'll tell you what. Yeah, Jimmy's a good lad. Jimmy's been to see Ronnie and Reggie, hasn't he?
Yeah, years ago he went to Parkhurst to see my old mate Joe Pyle and all.
Yeah, oh, I tell you who messaged me the other day. Maureen Flanagan. Oh, she's been having people messaging her saying, you don't know the craze and all this, and giving her loads of grief. And she said about when he was on the roof at Broadmoor, she walked past you with Ronnie and Reggie's mum, didn't she, and Charlie?
Yeah, I was up on the roof. It would have been about 1981.
Oh, that was the
she
first...
Was coming in to see Ronnie, and she was with Charlie and Violet, Ronnie's mother.
Right.
And I shouted down to Mrs. Clay, I shouted, have a lovely visit, and tell Ronnie I'm not going to touch one slate while the visit's going on. As soon as the visit ended, I waved goodbye to him, and I took the whole roof off.
You'd...
I spent more time on Broadmoor's roof than the fucking pigeons.
So you took the roof off in 1981, 1983 and 84, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was me hat trick. I've been on 9 prison roofs, you know, sir.
I know.
Hat trick, Broadmoor, 3.
Well, think of all the jobs... Think of all the jobs you've created.
Exactly. People don't
appreciate
that.
Exactly.
Don't appreciate it.
So what do you reckon now about getting out? Do you reckon we've got a good chance now? We've got this public parole hearing.
Right, there's a possibility I could be out by the end of this year. That's a possibility.
Yeah, well, this legal team we've got are brilliant, aren't they? Yeah, well, we're a team, aren't we? So what are your...
legal team, they all believe in me. But at the end of the day, son, you've got to remember this. There's only really one person ever going to get me out.
Well, that's yourself.
And that's myself.
I've told...
The way I've been behaving for the last few years, there's no reason why I can't get out.
Yeah, I've told you that.
Now, if I don't get out this year, it's almost certainly I'll be getting out next year, early next year.
Yeah, well, look how far you've come the last 3 years. I mean, you're just a complete changed man. Like I was saying to James, you know, we've been teaching you all about remorse and instead of regretting stuff, because you regret taking that guy hostage because you got time in prison, now you've totally changed and now you've got remorse and you're actually sitting there thinking, well, that poor bastard that I fucking took hostage, everything he's had to deal with all his life, and it's making you realise... you know, the error of your ways and realising what you've put people through rather than the consequences you've had to put up with being locked up.
Yeah,
And that's what. And that's what the parole people want to hear. They want to hear that you're remorseful and you understand what you've done to these people.
See,
so,
the truth is, the average screw prison officer who opens my door, they'll release me tomorrow because they know I'm no danger to the public.
They all say that when I come and visit you. Yeah.
They go on about rehabilitation. Right. I've rehabilitated myself. I'm a songwriter. I'm a singer.
You're in the charts. You're not just a songwriter. You're a fucking hit. You're a hit pop artist.
I'm a walking fucking genius. I don't even know.
Right, so when you get out, what are you going to do? I mean, we've talked about this loads, haven't we? Don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone where you're gonna go or anything.
Yeah. But well, it's no secret. I've got a 6-berth caravan. What you sorted for me?
Yeah.
A new caravan. Even though I've asked you to put bars on the windows and barbed wire on the roof, even though you won't do it, but that's my home, my 6-berth caravan.
Yeah.
I'm gonna do my art. Make a living with my art. I'm gonna do a lot for charities. I'm going to do my training.
And work at the crime museum.
I've got a job at the crime museum. So there's everything waiting for me out there. Everything.
Yeah.
The reason I'm not going to London or Luton or a big town, I'm not going to say where I'm going, but I'm going somewhere where there's not a lot of people. I'm right next to the seaside.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just going to enjoy my life.
Can't wait, you deserve it now. You've been out of trouble for so long.
I'm excited now. I can actually. I'm closer now to getting out than I've been in 30 years.
And do you know what's really good now?
Yeah.
It's like I've said to you, over the last few years, this is the first time in your life where you've actually. You're not sat there as a lost cause. You actually know you've got something to work forward to now, to actually get out. You've got a goal, and you know that if you smack one of the guards or hit someone, that's the last nail in your coffin. You're never going to get out.
Do you know what? I've come to that stage in my life where I'm now able to walk away.
Yeah.
I'm able to walk away.
Yeah. I mean, that's massive for you, isn't it?
To anybody. I just want to live a beautiful, lovely life.
Have you?
And, you know, I'm not far off 70 there, and I'd like to think when I'm 70, it's a couple of years' time, I should be out there enjoying what's left of me life.
Have you got any regrets?
Regrets?
Have you got any regrets at all?
Have I got any? I have got one regret, just one. I missed the Strange Ways riot by 9 days. They moved me from Strange Ways 9 days before the riot and I ended up in Parkhurst. This is 30 years ago, this 1990 it was. And after they moved me, 9 days, the riot went off. So I missed the biggest riot in history in Britain. By 9 days.
Hey, I went. You organised for me to go and meet Alan Lord. Do you remember in Manchester?
Yeah.
He's a lovely fella, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's
been on.
Top geezer. He got a life sentence when he was young. He spent must have been about 28, 29 years locked up. He learned his lesson. He's out there now, works in a gym. He turned his life round.
Yeah, we sent him some money to help fix the roof in the gym, didn't we?
Yeah, sold a bit of art and helped him out.
Yeah, he's
always help me, mate.
He's a lovely bloke.
What's Vicky Dark doing there?
Yeah, Vic's doing good.
I don't know Vicky Dark.
Yeah, he's doing well.
Well, if you bump into him, just give him my respects because it was an absolute pleasure to do a bit of porridge with that man.
An absolute pleasure to do a bit of porridge. Hey, I was saying about there's no porridge in prison anymore. You have to have Rice Krispies now, don't you?
Well, I'm ashamed to have to say this, but it's now 2021 and I'm buying my own fucking porridge.
It's outrageous, isn't it?
Now, if I was walking around an exercise yard 40 years ago and I said to someone, well, do you know what? In 2021, 2021, I'll be buying me own porridge. And they looked at me and said, Charlie, you need to go back to Broadmoor, mate.
I was just saying as well, do you remember that? Remember when I came to see you just before COVID?
Yeah.
And I think it was at Wardell. And they took me in the wrong room and put me in with that Michael Adebowaji. Yeah, they put me in with Michael Adebowaji, didn't they?
Unbelievable. What about when you was up in Wakefield and Frankly, you saw all them monsters?
Oh, do you know what? I forgot to tell him about that. When I met Robert Maudsley. When I met Bob Maudsley, when you said go to the window and say hello to Bob, so I put my head up at the window. I went, all right, Bob. And he had his face about an inch from me. I went, all right, Bob, nice to meet you. And he looked at me and he opened his mouth, smiled with his teeth. And I turned round and you was in your cage pissing yourself. And I was like, what are you laughing at? And you went, do you know who that was? And I went, no. And he went, it's a fucking cannibal. Oh, he's gone. He's gone.
Yeah, that was class, man.
Oh, that's good. Didn't ring him, wasn't it?
That was class. Perfect timing. What was it like then going through the process? Did you know much about your dad before he gave you the call?
Well, it's quite interesting. It's a good question, that, because when someone says to you, do you want to go meet Charles Bronson? The first thing your arse does, it starts fucking tweaking like a blood orange. And you're like, fucking hell, Charles Bronson? Why would I want to go and see him? He's a fucking raving nutcase. He's a lunatic. Because, you know, he's always labelled in the papers as the most violent prisoner, the most volatile. You know, he takes hostages, ties people up, beats the shit out. But you've seen the film. I mean, every time, you know, all the screws say he's the hardest bloke that they've ever come across in their fucking lives. And even when 12 of them go into a room, they shit themselves when there's 12 of them all tooled up. So, I mean, what's it not to be scared about? I absolutely fucking shit myself. But now I've been and seen him so many times. I've seen him loads of times. You know, I used to go to see him every 2 weeks. I've visited him at Wakefield. I visited him at Franklin. I visited him at Woodhill. You know, I've sat there with him, and fucking Ian Huntley's been sat over there, like, dressed as a bird with all makeup on and a fucking blonde wig in a dress. And I've seen some crazy shit while I've been visiting him. I've met Robert Maudsley. You know, I've seen fucking Roy Whiting and Peter Sutcliffe and all these. It's just, it's a completely different world. It's a different world. It's a world that we're just not used to.
How does Charlie get on with these people? Do they
fucking hate them? They won't let him anywhere near them because he would, Ian Huntley, you know, I mean, I say Charlie's not a violent person anymore, and he's not. He's totally changed. He's so chilled out. And so, I mean, you won't want to fuck with him because he'd rip your legs off. You know, he'd walk into a pub in Glasgow with 10 of the hardest blokes you want and rip fucking shreds out. It'd be like someone plucking a load of turkeys. You just see loads of feathers coming out the doors. He's hard as fuck. I would not want to cross him.
Because I think one of the paedophiles, one of his stories, he nearly killed a paedophile. Strangled him to death.
Yeah, that was in Broadmoor, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And he strangled him that hard. He actually, he's told me this story a few times. His dad went to visit him and he said to his dad, oh, can I have that tie? And his dad gave him a silk tie. And he gave him the tie and he kept the tie. And then when he waited, he was sat in the room in Broadmoor. And you see it in the film Bronson. He goes up behind him and puts the tie around his neck and pulls it, and he pulled it and pulled it and pulled it, and then the guards come and rushed him off and pulled him off. In real life, the reason why that guy survived was he pulled the tie that hard that he actually snapped the tie in half. And that's the fucking strength of the guy.
Yeah. How was it being for you, for being that man, the confessions of the paparazzis, to then Charlie Bronson, the most punished prisoner in Britain, saying he's your dad? Was that hard for people to think it was a scam or a con, to then, when you're trying to grow a relationship with him, you've had the DNA tests, you've had the saliva tests, you've had hair tests, and the both of them come back to say that 99.9% that he's your dad? How did you deal with that, not really having a dad growing up, to then Charlie Bronson being your dad? It must have been mad for you.
Yeah, the thing that I found hardest about it was, at the time I didn't realise, there was all these Facebook groups and all these groups of all these people that fucking worship me old man, and they go online, they've got all these groups about him, Charles Bronson this, Charles Bronson that. And when he married Paula, they were all like, oh, Paula, fucking slag. She just wants to be with him for fucking fame and all that. The fucking, she's had more cock than a farmhouse. All this shit they were saying. Really horrible, nasty things. Paula was a really lovely person. She was. She had a heart of gold. She was one of the nicest people I've ever met. She was mentally fucked in the head. She had a lot of issues. She had a lot of problems with, like, drugs, prescription drugs and all the rest of it. But as a person, you couldn't want to meet a nicer person. She was a loyal friend. She'd do anything for anybody. But she was taking all these barrages of, like, trolls and insults and people saying the most horrible things about her, which I believe contributed to her dying. I believe when she died, she kept ringing me up all the time saying she's going to take an overdose, she's going to kill herself, she's going to end her life, and all. It was just awful. But what happens with Charlie? People get close to him. And there was one guy in particular, a guy called Rod Harrison. He was so close to Charlie. He was his mate. He organised this, he organised that. Charlie's my mate. I've known Charlie 44 years through the bare knuckle boxing. I've known him for years. He's been my mate all my life and all this. And then what had happened was, Charlie would be sending him all his artwork. He'd be selling all his artwork and making loads of money off it and giving Charlie a bit of money in, a bit of money there and whatever, topping his canteen up and everything. And then what happened was, it got to the stage where anything that happened with Charlie had to go through this fucking guy, right? He was like the head of this Bronson empire, and he just controlled everything. So in my relationship as his son, I went to see him one day and I said, listen, I've got this fucking guy telling me what to do, telling me what not to do and all the rest of it. I said, I ain't fucking listening to anybody. I'm not listening to any shit, any fucking groups or any whatever. Right, we've got a relationship, and if you want to have a relationship with me, then we have a relationship, and I'm not fucking answering to anybody, and that's it. And he went, well, you shouldn't be fucking answering to anyone. I said, so what about this fucking idiot then? He reckons, you know, he's known you for 50 years, he's done this, he's done... He went, I've known him for about 5 years. He started writing to me a few years ago, asking me for signed photos and blah, blah, blah. So I started sending him a few things. He started selling him. Then he sent me a few quid and we've been friends and that's how we built up our friendship. And he's like, I ain't fucking known him for all them years. It's a load of bollocks. But he's... And then what happened was he started this big campaign with all these other fucking idiots saying he doesn't know... He's not Charlie's son. They've not had a DNA test done. They've not done this. They've not done that. He said something about... I said that I'd had a hair tested when I went to Wakefield. Basically, when all this come out, I was getting loads of fucking hassle off the press and the papers and the telly and all the rest of it, saying about you being Charles Bronson's son. How do you know you're his son? I knew he was my dad. I knew from what he told me was going on and all the rest of it. So me, stupidly, I just sort of said, well, I went to see him and he gave me a hair from his moustache and I took it home and then he rang me and said, get that tested. And I said, well, I got it tested and that was it. Worst thing I ever fucking did. Because then you got all these twats going, you can't have these hairs tested, you can't have this, you can't have that, blah, blah. So anyway, got in touch with the prison service, and anybody can get in touch with the prison service and speak to them and confirm this. I got in touch with them and said, right, I believe my dad is Michael Peterson, known to you as Charles Bronson. Charlie put an application in and we had a DNA test done at the prison in Wakefield by the prison service, an official DNA. And it was done by them, by a doctor that came on a visit and swabbed us both individually, sent them off. And the DNA came back 99.9%. That's it. I don't speak about it to anyone else. I don't get involved. If all these fucking idiots want to say whatever they want to say, then let them crack on. I'm not really arsed.
Who was that for you the day you found out it was his dad? Were you emotional?
Well, I already knew he was my dad. So, I mean, it wasn't much of a shock. But it's just that final...
It's a fuck you to people as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like... Yeah, but the thing is, why do I have to explain my life to anybody?
It's because probably the life you led before it, though, because of the blagging you did do, for the outside people looking in, the shit that you've done, dressing up, kissing you're the gas man to take photos of the prince, to then the most punished prisoner in Britain, the most well-known prisoner that you've become his son. So people are going to go, wait a minute, something's not right there.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not like, you know, I mean, when I was brought up as a kid... I was brought up to fucking blag and do whatever I did to get food. I mean, in my bedroom, I didn't fucking eat for days on end. There was times where I had to nick like 3 pieces of bread and hide them under my bed and make them last fucking 3 days. And like, I used to cut the crust off and roll the bread up and dip it in water until it got really fucking soggy in a cup. And then it made like a big lump of stuff that I could eat to fucking feed myself. I used to blag myself my way through life just to survive. And that's how it went on with all the paparazzi stuff that I did. But, you know, as far as Charlie goes, you know, it's not the sort of stuff, you know, the prison service aren't going to wear someone just turning up and going, oh, yeah, that's your son, yeah, you know. And when I go in and on my pass, it says, George Bambi Salvador, son, visiting Charles Bronson. You know, they've got all the DNA results there. They've got all my information on the public records, on the files. The Ministry of Justice have got everything. And they knew I was his son anyway, because when I went for the original protocol and documentation, all the rest of the shit, to go and visit him, they cleared me within 48 hours.
Has he got other kids, Charlie? Two
yeah,
other
I've,
sons?
Got a I've got a half-brother called Michael, Michael Peterson. He's not well at the minute. He's in a clinic in up north. He's had a lot of really bad mental health problems and drug problems and stuff.
That's a shame, man.
And he's in a clinic at the minute, but he's a couple of years older than me.
When was the last time your dad was in, like, the loony bin, like Broadmoor, stuff like that?
He's not been in Broadmoor for about 20 years.
So a long time?
Yeah, he says, no, it's probably more than that, 30 years ago. I think it was like 85, 86... that he left Broadmoor. But like he always says now, he's the only prisoner in the British penal system at the moment that's got a certificate off Broadmoor to say that he's sane.
He's been in the three psychiatric hospitals in
I've been in Rampton, Ashworth.
Yeah, Ashworth, that's the three, isn't it, in Broadmoor?
Yeah, in Broadmoor. Like, oh, no, I'm not sure if he's been in Ashworth.
Yeah, he has.
Oh, has he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely been in Rampton.
So, did they nearly kill him in Broadmoor? They injected him?
Oh, yeah, they used to just beat the fucking... See, the thing is, the prison service are a fucking disgrace because there's all this mental health stuff and there's all these criminals. And then you've got criminals with mental health problems. You know, you've got the criminally insane and you've got the insane. You've got people in there, in Broadmoor, that are insane, that sit there, have a shite in their hand and eat it. And they're insane, right? You've got people in there that murdered like 10 kids and they're criminally insane. And what happens is, when they get someone in the prison system that they just can't control... They do what's just called nutting them off. That's what Charlie says. They nut them off and go, right, Broadmoor. Because when they send them to Broadmoor, when they can't control them, basically they used to pin them down, like 12 guys at a time, and they'd inject them in their arse with a liquid cosh. And it would paralyse them for 3 days. I mean, they literally could not move apart from the mouth, spit coming out the mouth. But one of the interesting things is, Broadmoor's classed as a hospital. It's a hospital, isn't it? So why are all the staff that work at Broadmoor all paid by the prison service? They're all prison officers. So it's not a fucking hospital. Yeah, so it's
not
a prison.
Doctors and nurses, it's just people...
It's a prison.
Yeah, dumbing your mind down to quiet you down.
It's a prison where they can just inject you, lock you in a fucking room and not have to worry about it.
Does your dad know the stories that he's done as mad, though? Like, who was the two Iraqi guys he took hostage and he got to tickle his feet and stuff and he wanted a helicopter?
Yeah, there was three of them. Yeah, he read in the paper one morning these Iraqi hostages had hijacked a plane from Baghdad or Tehran or whatever, landed at an airport in London, and they'd been arrested. And I think it was Belmarsh, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was in Belmarsh. So they put him in Belmarsh, and he was like, oh, right, yeah, you want to fucking take some British people hostage, do you? Right, you fuckers. I'll fucking take you hostage.
Have been thinking, what the fuck have we got ourselves into? Charlie Bronson's sitting there saying, tickle my feet.
So basically, the three of them were in the cell, and he just walked in and he went, all right, boys, shut the door. And he went, right, you fucking three are hostages of me now. And that was it. And he tied one of them up and put them under the bed.
I'm laughing
because there was three of them and there wasn't enough room for three of them in the cell, so he put one of them under the bed, and the other one he put a noose round his neck with a rope on it, And the other one, he said, right, you fucking tickle my feet. And he just lay there and made him tickle his feet. And I think he had him for 3 days, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he's wanting a helicopter on that as well.
He wanted, I think that's, what did he ask for? He wanted a helicopter, an AK-47.
And a sandwich.
And some jam sandwiches, And I said to him, fucking, a helicopter, an AK-47 and some jam sandwiches. And he went, yeah, I was hungry.
What's the maddest story he's ever told you?
Oh, he said he wanted a helicopter to get him to take him to Mexico. Mm-hmm. I want a fucking helicopter to take him to Mexico. You need a petrol tank on it about five times the size of a fucking helicopter to get him to Mexico.
What's the maddest story he's ever told you that you've been shocked?
He's told me some stories that have really, really badly shocked me. I mean, this is what I'm saying about all this mental health stuff. A lot of the stuff that he's seen,
trauma.
It's fucking trauma. I'm convinced he's got PTSD. He's done all sorts of stuff. I mean, fucking hell. There was one guy once that, I think he had a mop. There was a mop and a brush on the wing. And he was with Ronnie and Reggie in Parkhurst. And, I'll tell you another story. This is fucking
brilliant. Tell me that one as well, though.
Yeah. Well, I might as well tell you now. So he had the gold mop and the gold thing, and he painted him gold. And he said to everyone, right, this is my mop and this is my bucket. If anyone wants to use it, you can use it as long as you put it back. And they were like, yeah, all right, Charlie. Anyway, this one guy kept borrowing the mop bucket and didn't bring it back. And he went into his cell one day and he went, listen, I fucking told you once, you borrowed me mop bucket, you borrowed me mop, and you've not brought it back. I'm fucking warning you. You do it again, and there's going to be trouble. And he's like, all right. It's only a fucking mop and a bucket. And he's like, well, it's my fucking mop and it's my bucket. Because you don't have many things in prison. So, anyway, a couple of days later, he's used his mop bucket, gone off, and he's not brought it back. So Charlie's gone into Ronnie or Reggie's cell and said, right, I've fucking had enough of this twat. I've had enough of it. I'm going to do him. So he walked into his cell and he had a tomato sauce bottle and he smashed the tomato sauce bottle and he just kept fucking stabbing him with it and stabbing him and stabbing him and stabbing him and just basically cut him to bits. And, just an absolute moment of psychoticness. And I think a culmination of all the trauma that he's gone through and all the rest of it, where he's just lost the plot and he did that. And that's when they nutted him off and sent him to Broadmoor. So he's turned up at Broadmoor and they sat there at the table and they're having some dinner. And See, I don't follow all the gangster stuff. Mm-hmm. I've never been involved in the gangster stuff. I'm not interested. I'm interested in helping my dad and that's it. Was it Ronnie that was at Broadmoor?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he sat there with Ronnie and they're at the table and this guy came up to him and he went, oi! To my dad, he goes, oi, I want a word with you. Charlie went, what? I'm watching fucking Top of the Pops. What do you want? What do you want? He goes, I want a fucking word with you. And he went, what? He went, right, what I want is, I want you to take me in the fucking recess room and I want you to punch fuck out of me. And Charlie's gone, you what? You want me to do what? He's gone, I want you to take me in the recess room. I want you to punch fuck out of me. And Charlie's gone, I ain't fucking doing that. I'm watching Top of the Pops now. Fuck off and leave me alone, right? So he's gone off. Anyway, Ronnie's there reading the paper and he's turned round to my dad and he's gone, Charlie, he won't fucking leave you alone until you beat fuck out of him. He says, you'll have to do it. Honestly, he won't leave you alone. So Charlie's like, fucking hell. Anyway, about 10 minutes later, he comes up and he goes, right, I fucking mean it. I want you to kick fuck out of me. He says, I want you to kick fuck out of me and I want you to do it now. And Charlie's gone, right, fucking get down the recess. I'll be there in a minute. So he's gone down in the recess. So Charlie's walked in and he's walked in. He's gone, right. He's had a look around. He's running around. He's gone, right, what do you want then? A couple of fucking body shots? Or he said, no, I want you to fucking just steam into me. So he's just steamed into him and just knocked the absolute living shit out of him. And then walked back and sat down with Ronnie. And Ronnie's gone, did you give him a good hiding? He went, oh, fucking right. Yeah. He said, I've given him a good hiding, all right. So that was it. So a couple of days later, He sat there having his dinner or whatever, and his guy came up to him again and he says, I want you to give me another good hiding. He said, I fucking really enjoyed that. He went, you fucking what? He goes, yeah, I want you to give me another good hiding. He went, fuck off, I'm not doing that again. You'll get me into trouble now, fuck off and leave me alone. And the guy goes, right. He says, I'll tell you something now. He said, I've got all these fucking cuts and scars on my face. If you don't take me down the back and give me a fucking good hiding, I'm going to get me social worker, I'm going to get me fucking nurse, I'm going to report you to the police, I'm going to have you done for assault, I'm going to have you fucking in banging trouble. Charlie went, right, get your fucking ass down that fucking recess. And then he went down and battered fucking
who was
again.
That? Just a crack.
Just some what? Fucking nutcase in Broadmoor.
What was the other story you were going to say there?
They sat there. Him and Ronnie were sat, used to sit on the same table having dinner. And there was this big, massive black fella, and this little white fella. And there's some butter on the table. And they're having the dinner, just buttering the bread and all this. And this little white guy got this big lump of butter and put it on his thing. And the black guy next to him just picked up this knife, grabbed hold of his head and just stabbed him in the eye, like that, literally in his eye. And Charlie said it was one of the most traumatic things he's ever seen. He was like, fucking hell, what did you do that for? And he's like, he fucking took too much butter. And Charlie was like, he took too much butter and you've done that.
So when your dad got prisoned, it was like 7 years for robbery.
Armed robbery,
and then
yeah.
It was just constantly fighting, taking hostages, battling prison guards and all this shit. But in 2000, is that when he took the art teacher hostage?
Yeah, that was Phil Danielson.
What was
yeah.
the real story about that?
He just slagged his artwork off. I mean, Charlie, there's a really good screw called Mick O'Hagan. And one day, Charlie was in his cell and he was just up to his tether, nothing to do, fucking screaming out for some stimulation. I mean, if you lock someone in a cell for like 10 years and don't let them come out and all the rest of it, I mean, it's going to fuck you up mentally, isn't it? Mm. So this Mick O'Hagan went down one day and says, yeah, Charlie, here's a few pens and pencils and a bit of paper. See what you can do with that. And he started drawing pictures. And it really helped him to rehabilitate himself, gave him loads of therapy, and he does all his artwork. And he does it all now. And, you know, and that's his outlet. That's what he does. And that's what gets him through the days. And this Phil Danielson, the art teacher, they were there doing all this art, and Charlie was doing some of his artwork. And Phil Danielson said it was shit, he didn't like it. And Charlie thought, right, fuck you. So took him hostage. But I think the reason why he took him hostage was he was bored. And that sounds stupid. He took someone hostage and tortured them for 3 days because they were bored. But if you think about being locked in a cell for that amount of time, then he said to me, you'd do anything to be out yourself for 3 days. And that's sad, that, isn't it?
What's the longest he's been in solitary confinement for?
Oh, he's been in solitary confinement for years without being let out, with being fed in Wakefield in the cage. There's a cell with a cage, and you open the door, and as you open the door, it's literally a cage door.
Like an animal?
Yeah, and they literally open the door and fucking lob his thing under like a letterbox at the bottom of the door and just slide it in and shut the door.
How did the screws treat Charlie?
Well, I don't know how they treated him years ago. The story he's told me, from the stories he's told me, they used to beat the shit out of him. And also, don't forget, you know, Charles Bronson, it's not like he's not a big name in the prison system. He's probably the biggest name in the prison system. So if you get a group of screws that are sat there one night, 8 or 10 of them, and they're like a bit bored, they're like, oh, fuck it, should we go and batter Bronson? And they just open the door and steam in and smash the shit out of him, and then they go home to the wives, oh yeah, we fucking battered that Bronson, we give him a good hiding today. And that's what it was like in them days.
Yeah.
If someone, they had an argument with someone, they won't talk to him, they just go in and smash the fuck out of him, basically.
So Charlie Bronson was the actor, the American actor he got his name from, and then he changed it to Salvador. Was he an artist?
Salvador Dali, yeah. He bases his art and his icon is Salvador Dali, the artist. That's why he changed his name to Charles.
He makes money from his art. What's the most he's ever made from a painting?
Some of his paintings have sold for 20 grand.
Have they?
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
It is phenomenal, but his artwork is phenomenal. It's brilliant. Have you seen it?
Yeah. Some of it, yeah.
I'll get you a piece.
Yeah, definitely.
Get you your own piece.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
I'll tell you something now. He does more for charity than anybody knows about. And the problem is, with all the stories in the paper, I do a lot of the newspaper stuff and the media stuff. And if you've noticed over the last 12 months, most of it's all been about, like, we had something, big things in the papers, the front page last week in the Sunday Star. And it was all about him doing a number one hit record and making money for this charity, Calm, which is a mental health charity. There's loads of charity. But what we've done is, in the past, all these knobheads that have been hanging around him have all been, like, doing little things in the paper. Oh, Charlie's fucking hit one of the screws or whatever. You know, get a couple of hundred quid. And they're not asked about what repercussions that's had with my dad. So what I've done is, with my experience with the media, and I've got a lot of contacts and I've got quite a lot of power within certain papers, I've built up relationships with people that have not been about making loads of money. They've been about the content of what's gone into the papers. And most of the stories that come out now are like, oh, Charlie's doing really well with his artwork. He's got his parole coming up. He's doing this. He's doing his artwork. He's raising money for this. He's raising money for that. And like, I spoke to him a few months ago, and I said, how do you fancy making a record? He went, I'm fucking making a record? How can I fucking make a record? I'm stuck in here. I went, well, you can write a song. I'll record the lyrics, and then we'll get a band involved. And we got this band in Las Vegas, in Cyprus, called Lost Vegas. And it was done through a very good friend of mine, Ashley Sims. And I got all the lyrics, got everything recorded with Ash and this guy, Chris Topless. Mixed it all together. We paid a good few hundred quid to get it all mixed and all done and all that. And it was released last week, and it gone straight in at number one in Cyprus, number three in Sweden, and number 31 in the UK charts.
Why Cyprus?
Because, I don't know.
It's mad, isn't it? Do you think that can change people's perception? Like, if you're hearing the stories, that's what people know Charlie as, is the most punished prisoner in Britain, but he's also known as being the most violent. So see, if you're sitting in the parole boards, you're maybe going to, Charlie's coming up for parole that day, and there's a negative story that day, they're reading in the paper, oh, he's done this and done that. That would have major effects. So you're trying to change and put the positive spin on it.
Well, I'm trying to build up the real Charlie, because you mentioned Charles. I went to see Anne Widdecombe not so long ago, the MP. She lived down near us in Devon. I took my missus round. I just went round and knocked on the door and went, all right, Anne, I'm local to Devon or whatever, and with my wife, so there's any chance we can have a chat? And she went, yeah, yeah. She invited me into the house, fair play to her. So we sat in the living room, made us a coffee, come in, and she went, right, what can I help you with? And I said, well, I've come to see you. I said, because you know Charles Bronson, the prisoner? And she went, yeah. And I said, Charlie's my dad. And the fucking look on her face, she went grey. She's like, all right, thinking, who am I just let into my house? I said, listen, no need to be worried about talking to us, whatever. We've just come around for a chat, you know, with nice people, same as Charlie. I said, when you were the prison minister, all I want to try and find out is when you were the prison, because we're trying to find out what we can do with the parole and all the rest to give him the best chance to get out. So it's like, when you were the prison minister, why didn't you let Charlie out of prison? And she turned around to me and said, because he was a murderer. So I went, it was a murderer? Yeah, I said, right, yeah, he was a murderer. I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, can you remember how many people he killed? And she turned around and she went, well, I don't know from the top of my head. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it was like, I'd have to look it up, but I think it was like 9 or 12 people that he murdered. And I turned around to her and I said, he's never murdered anybody. He's never hurt a kid. He's never raped a woman or hurt a woman. And he's never murdered anybody. And she went, well, I'm sure he has. I said, well, he hasn't. I said, but if you were the Minister of Justice at the time, and you were the one to sign that bit of paper to let him out, if you're sitting here thinking he's killed fucking 12 people, it's no wonder you didn't fucking let him out. Yeah.
Do you think he's ever been scared to come out because he's been so institutionalised that it can be a bit of fear to come out?
I mean, obviously, we've had loads of conversations about this, and I've spoken to loads of psychologists and people that we've got on board, mental health people and all this. And he is going to be institutionalised. There's no doubt about it. I was in hospital for 2 years and I didn't want to leave. He's been in prison for 46 years and it's all he knows. But like he keeps saying to me, I can't be institutionalised because I hate prison. So, you know, Harry Roberts that killed the three coppers that got let out, he'd been in for years and years and years. He's come out and rehabilitated himself.
How did the film with Tom Hardy come about?
Basically, the company got in touch, Vertigo Films, and just said, it's a fucking great story and we want to do it.
Great actor. Is it true that when he used to rub butter and stuff on himself. Is that all true?
Oh, he still does that now, yeah. Yeah, when he gets a bit bored, he did that. I think the last time he did that was a couple of years ago. I think it was in Whitefield, about 3 years ago. And he'd been saving up his butter, saving it up in a little bag, and then he puts it in his boxers under his ball sack, his boxers on, and he goes out with his shorts and his T-shirt on. He gets in the yard to do all his dips and all that. And these 12 of them used to take him out with all riot shields and sticks and everything. And once you lock him in his cage in his exercise yard, he has his own little cage. There's two of them wait outside. And then they sit there talking while Charlie's doing all his bits or whatever. And he just gets the butter out, rubs it all over himself. And then he turns round and his eyes comes down and he just goes, "Right, get your fucking mates." And they look at him and go, "What?" And he's going, "Get your fucking mates, you're going to need them." And he's covered in butter. And then 12 of them go in and he's like, "Right, fuck it." And then he just...
goes for it. How's his relationship with Tom Hardy now?
Well, I don't think he spoke to Tom for a couple of years. But it's like anything with Charlie, you know. I mean, Tom was really nice to him because obviously he wanted to do the film when he went to see him and learn all about him and all the rest of it. But since Bronson came out, the prison service have banned Tom from visiting him.
Why is that?
Well, because he just brought a film out, Bronson. It's a fucking Hollywood blockbuster. And it's all over the place, Netflix, and everyone knows it. And they don't want prisoners being portrayed into being big movie stars.
Does your dad get many celebrities still in contact with him?
Yeah, loads of them. He's got loads of pals. You know, Barbara Windsor used to go and visit him. Ray Winston's a mate of his. You know, Danny Dyer. Loads of them, yeah.
Going forward for the future then, you're trying to get your dad out. What would be the plans to be for his life when he gets out?
Well, we've already got him a caravan down in the southwest. And it's about 80 yards from the beach. It's got a chippy on site. It's got a gym on site. It's a private place, so not everyone can just walk in. So give him a bit of privacy. One of his rooms been turned into an art studio. He's going to get a couple of dogs, Ronnie and Reg. Got a barbecue outside. We've got the crime museum in Torquay that we own. And all his artwork's in there and loads of old stuff from all his friends from the craze and all the rest of it. And all that's in the museum. That's open all the time. He wants to go and work in there. And then people can come and visit the museum and talk to him. And
how do you think he'll handle that? Because everybody will want a piece of his attention, but I'd imagine you'd guide them into kind of keeping him away from that shit.
Yeah, it's just all about sort of putting a bit of a barrier around him. Because you know what it's going to be like. You know, when he comes out, I mean, I've had phone calls to ITV, "We'll give you £500,000 for the first interview when he comes out." You know, we want him to do this, we want him to fight that. He wants to do a talk. I'm just like, he's not fucking interested in any of that. He's not interested in money. He doesn't need money. He's already got a few quid. He's got enough to live on for the rest of his life. So anything that he wants to do, it will be because he wants to do it. And it's something that he wants to do. And 9 times out of 10, it might not even be about the money. It might be about the opportunity.
Do you think he can live a happy, healthy life when he gets out?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of sadness getting to know him.
In what way?
Just listening to the stories and, you know, everyone goes, "Oh, he's a fucking violent monster, he's an animal, he's this, he's that, he's other." But I listen to a lot of the stories of things that he's actually been through as well and things that he's had to deal with. And I think the system's failed him big time, properly failed him. He's not had any mental health care. He's not had any psychologists. I mean, all right, he's been offered them, but, you know, he's never had any. He's just been locked away and the key just hung up on the side.
Just rotting away, just a number.
Just rotting away, yeah.
Do you think it's therapy for him when he talks to you, when it's more deep instead of the people who know Charlie Bronson as the prisoner and the shit that he's done instead of understanding why he became the man that he became in prison?
Well, you've just seen from, you know, a conversation we've just had, you know, When we talk to each other and we spend time on the phone, you know, he's only allowed to talk in 15-minute blocks, so he rings me 3 or 4 times a night. So every day we spend an hour talking to each other. And we don't talk about, you know, these stories. I mean, the other day, he rang me up and he went, "Fucking hell, he's been fucking kicked off today. One of the guys next door's fucking slashed 2 of the guards up and cut him to bits and all that." And I was like, "Oh, fucking hell." He's like, "Well, you know, they must have asked for it." And I said, "Well, listen, hold on a minute. I talk to him the way I want to talk to him, and I'm not scared to talk to him in an educational way to make him realise. And I'm like, hold on a minute. These two guards that have had the faces slashed and all the rest of it by this inmate, do you not think that them two guards have got a fucking wife and family to go home to? And they're doing a job and they're getting paid to look after you in the prison. And so when I come and visit you, they're all really respectful to me and they look after me. They always ask me, I'm all right, make sure I've got a cup of tea, look after me. They're always really polite and respectful for you. And he's like, yeah, yeah, but you don't know how it is in prison. You don't know how it works in here. It's a different life. I said, yeah, it might be a different life. I said, but I don't give a fuck who they are. No one deserves to go to work and come home and end up in hospital with, like, the face slashed and shit like that. And he's like, yeah, no, you know, I've never thought about it like that. Because he's not used to that. He's just used to violence all the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, over the last 3 years, I've been educating him so much about consequences of things and what is acceptable and what's not acceptable and what behaviour, you know, is right and what behaviour is wrong. And, you know, like it's Phil Danielson. Years ago, he's like, I fucking regret doing that. I got a life sentence. If you ask him about it now, he'll be like, oh, I'm so remorseful. That poor guy, I should not have done that to him. I can't believe what I've put him through. I've ruined his life. I've fucking made him fear to ever work again. I can't live with myself. And that's the change.
How strong is he? Because I know people say that he's strong. Because he's broke world records and stuff, is he not?
Oh, fucking hell.
Is he a powerful man?
I've seen a picture of a cell door that he's fucking pulled open from the bottom and it's fucking bent up like you would open a baked bean tin. I can't imagine to tell you how strong he is.
Is he still training every day now?
Oh, he does 1,000 press-ups every morning when he gets up and 1,000 before he goes to bed at night. When I go and visit him, he does 100 press-ups. He does 90. I think his record is 96 press-ups in 30 seconds. And I'm just sat there with the screws, and they're like, "Have you got a timer, Gov?" And the Gov goes, "Right, 30 seconds, ready, go." And he's like, and he'll do 100 press-ups, and then he'd just jump up and eat a fucking Magnum ice cream that I've got from the canteen, and he won't even like be out of breath.
What kind of food does he eat?
Shit.
Is that?
Yeah. I mean, they all say, you know, it's great being in prison, you've got no rent or bills and you get 3 square meals a day. In the morning, they chuck him a fucking plastic bag with a bun in it and a bit of cheese or something. In the afternoon, they'll get some cold stuff in a packet, and then at tea, they might get a pork chop, a bit of mashed potato and some peas or whatever.
Has he ever says what he's missed most, being outside?
Yeah, he misses like going to like a local cafe and having a proper English fry up and having a good dinner, having a pint of Guinness. And he always says like some of the happiest memories that he has is when he's getting transferred from one nick to the other. Because they put him in a van and fucking tie him up and chain him up in the back and he literally can't move. And he looks out the window and sees the cows in the fields and the sheep and... Fucking sad, isn't it?
Yeah. Does it make you emotional leaving them after a visit?
Yeah, makes me emotional all the time. I mean, makes me quite upset sometimes when I'm with him and I'm talking to him and he's telling me some of the stories and stuff. Because everyone sees this fucking Charles Bronson, fucking hard bastard, don't fuck with him, he's a fucking nutcase, he's a lunatic. He's a person. And when you talk to him and you get to know him like I've done, as his fucking son, and we sit there and we talk to each other and we hug each other and fucking puts his arm around me, he's got emotion and he's got feeling and he gets upset and he gets, you know, and he's dead happy at the same time. But he's not got any regrets about his life. He wouldn't change a thing. And he's not a lot else to say, really. Yeah.
So just before we finish up, brother.
I've got to say hello to my little son, Lewis.
Of course, shout out to Lewis. How are you, brother?
Lewis.
Yeah, your dad's played an absolute blinder the day with this interview. This will do phenomenal. But for coming on, mate, and telling your story, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I really mean that. Can't wait to see your dad out. Fuck ITV and BBC, you know, the real interviewer is here, mate. I'll do it for free. I don't mind.
Yeah, Oh, it's been nice. Do you know what? It's not only been nice to talk to you as a person, but it's also been nice to have the opportunity to explain a little bit more in depth about what my old man's like, because he's not the monster that everyone portrays him to be.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If you were sat here with him now having a chat, you'd be like, just one of the guys down the pub. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know yourself how the media can portray people.
Yeah, it's fucking heartbreaking.
Would you like to finish up on anything? What's your businesses, sorry, before, what's your businesses? Would you like to promote them or anything?
No. I've got a book out, which is called George's World, which is on Amazon. And that's all about all my childhood. And it goes right up until the minute I met my dad. And then, so that's called George's World. That's on Amazon. And I've also had a film made about my life, and that's on Amazon Prime. You can get that on Amazon Prime, and it's called Stepdad. And that's my whole childhood and stuff. I was one of the first people in the UK to prosecute my mum and stepdad.
Takes a bit of bottle fucking as well, man. You've been through the wars yourself, Georgie, and you've come through a lot of shit. And listen, I can't wait to see your old boy out and hopefully get to meet him one day. But for coming on today, George, and telling your story, I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Nice one, mate.
Shout out to Rodney as well, who your friend is.
Oh, mate, yeah, Rodney McMillan. I've come up to Glasgow to see him. He's just been given palliative care. He's in a really bad way. He's not got long. And hopefully, whatever we can do, we can try and do, but just been a really fucking sad few days, to be honest.
Nah, God bless you, George, and again, all right, nice thank one, you. James. Take care, mate.
Thanks a lot.
You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.